This is cassette number 3.
The past is gone, Nicky told the townspeople. You are part of the Imperial Order. If you people don't do the moral thing by contributing toward the well-being of your fellow citizens of the Order, I will return.
They did not doubt her. If there was one thing they obviously wanted, it was never to see her again. One of the soldiers, his fists trembling at his sides, tramped forward in halting steps. His eyes were wide with bewildered pain.
I want you back, darling, he growled in a voice that didn't match the startled expression in his eyes.
The voice turned deadly.
And I want you back right now.
There was no mistaking Chigang's voice or the rage in it. It was difficult for him to control the mind of one without the gift. He had the soldier in a tenacious grip. Chigang would not have used a soldier, thereby betraying his impotence, had he been able to reach in and control Nikki's mind. She had absolutely no idea why he had suddenly lost the link to her. It had happened before. She knew he would eventually reestablish his ability to hurt her. She had merely to wait.
You are angry with me, Excellency.
What do you think?
She shrugged.
Since Kadar was your better in bed, I would think you would be pleased.
Get yourself back here right now, the soldier roared in Chigang's voice. Do you understand? Right now.
Nicky bowed.
But of course, Excellency.
As she straightened, she yanked the soldier's long knife from the sheath at his belt and slammed it hilt-deep into his muscled gut. She gritted her teeth with the effort of pivoting the handle sideways, sweeping the blade in a lethal arc through his insides. She doubted the man felt his messy death, writhing at her feet while she waited for a carriage to make its way around the square. He died with Jagang's chuckle on his lips. Since a dreamwalker could only be in a living mind, for the time being, the afternoon returned to quiet. After her carriage rocked to a dusty halt, a soldier reached up and opened the door. She leaned out from the step, turning back to the crowd, holding the outside handrail in order to stand straight so they might all see her. Her blonde hair fluttered in the sunny breeze.
Do not forget this day, and how your lives were all spared by Jagang the Just. The commander would have murdered you. The emperor, through me, has instead shown his compassion. Spread the word of the mercy and wisdom of Jagang the Just, and I will have no need to return.
The crowd mumbled that they would.
Do you want us to bring the commander with us?
A soldier asked. The man, Kadar Kardif's loyal second, now wore Kardif's sword. Like vegetables, Fidelity's fresh vitality was fleeting, its final fate, stench and rot.
Leave him to roast as a reminder. Everyone else will return with me to Fairfield.
By your command,
he said with a bow. He circled his arm and ordered the men to mount up and move out.
Nicky leaned out farther and looked up at the driver. His Excellency wishes to see me. Although he has not said as much, I am reasonably sure he would like you to hurry.
Nicky took her place on the hard leather cushion inside, her back straight against the upright seat, while the driver let out a shrill whistle and cracked his whip. The team leaped forward, jerking the carriage ahead. With a hand on the windowsill, she steadied herself as the iron-bound wheels bounced over the hard, rough ground of the town square until they reached the road, where the carriage settled down into this familiar, jolting ride. Sunlight slanted in the window, falling across the empty cushion opposite her. The bold, bright patch glided off the seat as the carriage negotiated a curve in the road, finally slipping up to come to rest in her lap like a warm cat. Darkly clad riders to each side, ahead and behind, stretched forward over the withers of their galloping mounts. A rumbling roar, along with billowing plumes of dust, lifted into the air from the thundering hooves. For the moment, Nicky was free of Jagang. She was surrounded by 2,000 men, yet she felt totally alone. Before long, she would have pain to fill the terrible void. She felt no joy, no fear. She sometimes wondered why she felt nothing but the need to hurt. As the carriage raced toward Jigang, her thoughts were focused instead on another man, trying to recall every occasion that she had seen him. She went over every moment she had spent with Richard Cipher, or as he was now known, and as Jigang knew him, Richard Rao. She thought about his gray eyes. Until the day she saw him, she had never believed such a person could exist. When she thought about Richard, like now, only one haunting need burned in her: to destroy him. Chapter 9. Huge garish tents festooned the prominent hill outside the city of Fairfield. Yet despite the festive colors erected amid the gloom, despite the laughing, the shouting, the coarse singing, and the riotous excess, this was no carnival come to town, but an occupying army. The emperor's tents and those of his retinue were styled in the fashion of the tents used by some of the nomadic people from Jigang's homeland of Alturang, yet they were embellished far beyond any actual tradition. The emperor, a man vastly exceeding any nomadic tribal leader's ability to imagine, created his own cultural heritage as he saw fit. Around the tents, covering the hills and valleys as far as Nikki could see, the soldiers had pitched their own small grimy tents. Some were oiled canvas, many more were made from animal skins. Beyond the shared basics of practicality, there was uniformity only in their lack of conformity to any one style. Outside some of the shabby little tents, and almost as large, sat ornate upholstered chairs looted from the city. The juxtaposition almost looked as if it had been intentionally done for a comical effect. But Nikki knew the reality had no kinship to humor. When the army eventually moved on, such large, meticulously crafted items were too cumbersome to take, and would be left to rot in the weather. Horses were picketed haphazardly, with occasional paddocks holding small herds. Other enclosures held meat on the hoof. Individual wagons were scattered here and there, seemingly wherever they could find an empty spot. But in other places they had been set up side by side. Many were camp followers. Others were army wagons with everything from basic supplies to blacksmith equipment. The army brought along minimal siege equipment. They had the gifted to use as weapons of that sort. Brooding clouds scudded low over the scene. The humid air reeked of excrement from both animals and men. The green fields all around had been churned to a muddy morass. The 2,000 men who had returned with Nikki had disappeared into the sprawling camp like a sprinkling of raindrops into a swamp. An Imperial Order army encampment was a place of noise and seeming confusion, yet it was not as disorderly as it might appear. There was a hierarchy of authority, and duties and chores to attend. Scattered men worked in solitude on their gear, oiling weapons and leather, or rolling their chainmail inside barrels with sand and vinegar to clean it of rust, while others cooked at fires. Farriers saw to the horses. Craftsmen saw to everything from repairing weapons to fashioning new boots to pulling teeth. Mystics of all sorts prowled the camp, tending impoverished souls or warding troublesome demons. Duties completed, raucous gangs gathered together for entertainment, usually gambling and drinking. Sometimes the diversions involved the camp followers, sometimes the captives. Even surrounded by such vast numbers, Nikki felt alone. Jigang's absence from her mind left a feeling of staggering isolation, not a sense of being forsaken, but simply solitude by contrast. With the dreamwalker in her mind, not even the most intimate detail of life, no thought, no deed, could be held private. His presence lurked in the dark mental corners, and from there he could watch everything. Every word you spoke, every thought you had, every bite you took, every time you cleared your throat, every time you coughed, every time you went to the privy. You were never alone. Never. The violation was debilitating, the trespass complete. That was what broke most of the sisters, the brutal totality of it, the awareness of his constant presence in your mind, watching? Worse, almost, the dreamwalker's roots sunk down through you, but you never knew when his awareness was focused on you. You might call him a vile name, and with his attention elsewhere, it would go unnoticed. Another time you might have a brief, private, nasty thought about him, and he would know it the same instant you thought it. Nikki had learned to feel those roots, as had many of the other sisters. She had also learned to recognize when they were absent, as now. That never happened with the others. With them, those roots were permanent. Jagang always eventually returned, though, to once again sink his roots into her. But for now, she was alone. She just didn't know why. The jumble of troops and campfires left no clear route for the team, so Nikki had left her carriage for the walk the rest of the way up the hill. It exposed her to the lecherous looks and lewd calls of the soldiers who crowded the slope. She supposed that before Jagang was finished with her, she might be exposed to far more from the men. Most of the sisters were sent out to the tents from time to time to be used for the men's pleasure. It was done either to punish them, or sometimes merely to let them know it could be ordered on a whim, to remind them that they were slaves, nothing more than property. Nikki, though, was reserved for the exclusive amusement of the Emperor, and those he specifically selected, like Kadar Kardif. Many of the sisters envied her status, but despite what they believed, being a personal slave to Jagang was no grace. Women were sent to the tents for a period of time, maybe a week or two, but the rest of the time they had less demanding duties. They were valued, after all, for their abilities with their gift. There was no such time limit for Nikki. She had once spent a couple of months sequestered in Jagang's room so as to be there for his amusement any time of day or night. The soldiers enjoyed the women's company, but had to mind certain restrictions in what they could do to them. Jagang and his friends imposed on themselves no such limits. On occasion, for reason or not, Jagang would become furious at her and would heatedly order her to the tents for a month to teach her a lesson, he would say. Nikki would obediently bow and pledge it would be as he wished. He knew she was not bluffing. It would have been a lesser torment. Before she could be out the door to the tents, he would turn moody, command her to return to face him, and then angrily retract the orders. Since the beginning, Nikki had, measure by measure, inch by inch, acquired a certain status and freedom afforded none of the others. She hadn't specifically sought it. It just came about. Jagang had confided to her that he read the sisters' thoughts, and that they privately referred to her as the Slave Queen. She supposed Jagang told her so as to honor her in his own way. But the title Slave Queen had meant no more to her than Death's Mistress. For now, she floated like a bright water lily flower in the dark swamp of men. Other sisters always made an attempt to look as drab as the men, so as to go less noticed and be less desirable. They only deceived themselves. They lived in constant terror of what Jagang might do to them. What happened, happened. They had no choice or influence in it. Nikki simply didn't care. She wore her fine black dresses and left her long blonde hair uncovered for all to see. For the most part, she did as she wished. She didn't care what Jagang did to her, and he knew it. In much the way Richard was an enigma to her, she was an enigma to Jagang. Too, Jagang was fascinated by her. Despite his cruelty toward her, there was a spark of caution mixed in. When he hurt her, she welcomed it. She merited the brutality. Pain could sometimes reach down into the dark emptiness. He would then recoil from hurting her. When he threatened to kill her, she waited patiently for it to be done. She knew she didn't deserve to live. He would then withdraw the sentence of death. The fact that she was sincere was her safety and her peril. She was a fawn among wolves, safe in her coat of indifference. The fawn was in danger only if it ran. She did not view her captivity as a conflict with her interests. She had no interests. Time and again she had the opportunity to run, but didn't. That, perhaps more than anything, captivated Jagang. Sometimes he seemed to pay court to her. She didn't know his real interest in her. She never tried to discover it. He occasionally professed concern for her, and a few times, something akin to affection. Other times, when she left on some duty, he seemed glad to be rid of her. It had occurred to her, because of his behavior, that he might think he was in love with her. As preposterous as such a thought might be, it didn't matter one way or the other to her. She doubted he was capable of love. She seriously doubted that Jagang really knew what the word meant, much less the entire concept. Nikki knew all too well what it meant. A soldier near Jagang's tent stepped in front of her. He grinned moronically. It was meant to be an invitation by means of threat. She could have dissuaded him by mentioning that Jagang waited for her, or she could have even used her power to drop him where he stood, but instead she simply stared at him. It was not the reaction he wanted. Many of the men rose to the bait only if it squirmed. When she didn't, his expression turned sour. He grumbled a curse at her and moved off. Nikki continued on toward the Emperor's tent. Nomadic tents from Altur Rang were actually quite small and practical, being made of bland, unadorned lambskin. Jagang had recreated them rather more grandly than the originals. His own was more oval than round. Three poles, rather than the customary one, held up the multi-peaked roof. The tent's exterior walls were decorated with brightly embroidered panels. Around the top edge of the sides, where the roof met the walls, hung fist-sized multicolored tassels and streamers that marked the traveling palace of the Emperor. Banners and pennants of bright yellow and red atop the huge tent hung limp in the stale late afternoon air. Outside, a woman beat small rugs hung over one of the tent's lines. Nikki lifted aside the heavy doorway curtain embellished with gold shields and hammered silver medallions depicting battle scenes. Inside, slaves were at work sweeping the expanse of carpets, dusting the delicate ceramic ware set about on the elaborate furnishings, and fussing at the hundreds of colorful pillows lining the edge of the floor. Hangings, richly decorated with traditional Altur Rang designs, divided the space into several rooms. A few openings overhead, covered with gauzy material, let in a little light. All the thick materials created a quiet place amidst the noise. Lamps and candles lent sleepy light to the soft room. Nikki did not acknowledge the eyes of the guards flanking the inside of the doorway, or those of the other slaves going about their domestic duties. In the middle of the front room sat Jagang's ornate chair draped with red silks. This was where he sometimes took audiences, but the chair was empty. She didn't falter, as did other women summoned by His Excellency, but strode resolutely toward his bedroom in the rear section. One of the slaves, a nearly naked boy looking to be in his late teens, was down on his hands and knees with a small whisk broom sweeping the carpet set before the entrance to the bedroom. Without meeting Nikki's gaze, he informed her that His Excellency was not occupying his tents. The young man, Irwin, was gifted. He had lived at the Palace of the Prophets, training to be a wizard. Now Irwin tended the fringe of carpets and emptied the chamber pots. Nikki's mother would have approved. Jagang could be any number of places. He might be off gambling or drinking with his men. He could be inspecting his troops or the craftsmen who attended them. He might be looking over the new captives, selecting those he wanted for himself. He might be talking with Kadar Kardiv's second. Nikki saw several sisters cowering in a corner. Like her, they too were Jagang's slaves. As she strode up to the three women, she saw that they were busy sewing, mending some of the tent's gear. "Sister Nikki!" Sister Georgia rushed to her feet as a look of relief washed across her face. "We didn't know if you were alive or dead. We haven't seen you for so long. We thought maybe you had vanished." Being that Nikki was a sister of the dark, sworn to the keeper of the underworld, she found the concern from three sisters of the light to be somewhat insincere. Nikki supposed that they considered their captivity a common bond, and their feelings about it paramount, overcoming their more basic rifts. Too, they knew Jagang treated her differently. They were probably eager to be seen as friendly.
"I've been away on business for His Excellency."
"Of course,"
Sister Georgia said, dry washing her hands as she dipped her head. The other two, Sisters Rochelle and Aubrey, set aside the bag of bone buttons and tent thread, untangled themselves from yards of canvas, and then stood beside Sister Georgia. They both bowed their heads slightly to Nikki. The three of them feared her inscrutable standing with Jagang.
"Sister Nikki?" "His Excellency is very angry," Sister Rochelle said.
"Furious," Sister Aubrey confirmed. He railed at the walls, saying that you had gone too far this time."
Nikki only stared.
Sister Aubrey licked her lips. "We just thought you should know, so you can be careful."
Nikki thought this would be a poor time to suddenly begin being careful. She found the groveling of women hundreds of years her senior annoying. "Where's Jagang?"
"He has taken a grand building not far outside the city as his quarters," Sister Aubrey said. "It used to be the Minister of Culture's estate," Sister Rochelle added.
Nikki frowned.
"Why, he has his tents."
"Since you've been gone, he's decided that an emperor needs proper quarters," Sister Rochelle said.
"Proper? Proper for what?" "To show the world his importance, I suppose."
Sister Aubrey nodded.
"He's having a palace built in Altarang. It's his new vision."
She arced an arm through the air, apparently indicating with the slice of her hand the grand scale of the place.
"He's ordered a magnificent palace built." "He was planning on using the Palace of the Prophets," Sister Rochelle said, "but since it was destroyed, he's decided to build another, only better, the most opulent palace ever conceived."
Nikki frowned at the three women.
"He wanted the Palace of the Prophets because it had a spell to slow aging. That was what interested him."
All three women shrugged.
Nikki began to get an inkling of what Jagang might have in mind. "So, this place he's at now, what is he doing? Learning to eat with something other than his fingers? Seeing how he likes living the fancy life under a roof?"
"He only told us he was staying there for now," Sister Georgia said. "He took most of the younger women with him. He told us to stay here and see to things in case he wished to return to his tent."
It didn't sound like much had changed, except the setting. Nikki sighed. Her carriage was gone. She would have to walk.
"All right, how do I find the place?"
After Sister Aubrey gave her detailed directions, Nikki thanked them and turned to go.
"Sister Alessandra has vanished,"
Sister Georgia said in a voice straining mightily to sound nonchalant. Nikki stopped in her tracks. She rounded on Sister Georgia. The woman was middle-aged and seemed to look worse every time Nikki saw her. Her clothes were little more than tattered rags she wore with the pride of a fine uniform. Her thin hair was more white than brown. It might once have looked distinguished, but it didn't appear to have seen a brush, much less soap, for weeks. She was probably infested with lice, too. Some people looked forward to age as an excuse to become a frump, as if all along their greatest ambition in life had been to be drab and unattractive. Sister Georgia seemed to delight in dowdiness.
"What do you mean, Sister Alessandra has vanished?"
Nikki caught the slight twitch of satisfaction. Georgia spread her hands innocently.
"We don't know what happened. She's just turned up missing."
Still, Nikki did not move.
"I see."
Sister Georgia spread her hands again, feigning simple-mindedness.
"It was about the time the prelate disappeared, too."
Nikki denied them the reward of astonishment.
"What was Verna doing here?"
"Not Verna,"
Sister Rochelle said. She leaned in.
"Anne."
Sister Georgia scowled her displeasure at Rochelle for spoiling the surprise, and a surprise it was. The old prelate had died. At least that was what Nicky had been told. Since leaving the Palace of the Prophets, Nicky had heard about all the other sisters, novices, and young men spending the night at the funeral pyre for Anne and the prophet Nathan. Knowing Anne, there was obviously some sort of deception afoot, but even for her, such a thing would be extraordinary. The three sisters smiled like cats with a carp. They looked eager for a long game of truth and gossip.
"Give me the important details. I don't have time for the long version. His Excellency wishes to see me."
Nicky took in the three wilting smiles. She kept her voice level.
"Unless you want to risk him returning here, angry and impatient to see me."
Sisters Rochelle and Aubrey blanched. Georgia abandoned the game and went back to dry washing her hands.
"The prelate came to the camp when you were gone and was captured."
"Why would she come into Jagang's midst?"
"To try to convince us to escape with her," Sister Rochelle blurted out.
A shrill titter, jittery rather than amused, burbled up.
"She had some silly story about the chimes being loose and magic failing. Imagine that. Wild stories they were. Expected us to believe."
"So that was what happened,"
Nicky whispered as she stared off in reflection. She realized instantly it was no wild story. Pieces began fitting together. Nicky used her gift. The others weren't allowed to, so they might not know if magic had failed for a time.
"That's what she claimed,"
Sister Georgia said. "So magic had failed," Nicky reasoned aloud.
"And she thought that would prevent the dreamwalker from controlling your minds."
That might explain much of what Nicky didn't understand, why Jagang sometimes couldn't enter her mind.
"But if the chimes are loose..."
"Were,"
Sister Georgia said.
"Even if it was true for a time, they now have been banished. His Excellency has full access to us, I'm happy to say, and everything else concerning magic has returned to normal."
Nicky could almost see the three of them wondering if Jagang was listening to their words. But if magic was returned to normal, Jagang should be in Nicky's mind. He wasn't. She felt the spark of a possible understanding fizzle and die.
"So the prelate made a blunder and Jagang caught her."
"Well, not exactly," Sister Rochelle said.
"Sister Georgia went and got the guards. We turned her in, as was our duty."
Nicky burst out with a laugh.
"Her own sisters of the light. How ironic. She risks her life while the chimes have interrupted magic to come and save your worthless hides, and instead of escaping with her, you turn her in. How fitting."
"We had to,"
Sister Georgia protested.
"His Excellency would have wished it. Our place is to serve. We know better than to try to escape. We know our place."
Nicky surveyed their tense faces. These women sworn to the Creator's light. These sisters of the light who had worked hundreds of years in his name.
"Yes, you do."
"You'd have done the same,"
Sister Aubrey snapped.
"We had to, or His Excellency would have taken it out on the others. It was our duty to the welfare of the others, and that includes you, I might add. We couldn't think only of ourselves or Anne, but had to think of what was good for everyone."
Nicky felt the numb indifference smothering her.
"Fine. So you betrayed the prelate."
Only a spark of curiosity remained.
"But what made her think she could escape with you for good? Surely she must have had some plan for the chimes. What was she expecting to happen when Jagang once again had access to your minds and hers?"
"His Excellency is always with us," Sister Aubrey insisted.
"Anne was just trying to fill our heads with her preposterous notions. We know better. The rest of it was just a trick, too. We were too smart for her."
"Rest of it?
What was the rest of her plan?"
Sister Georgia huffed her indignation.
"She tried to tell us some foolishness about a bond to Richard Rawl."
Nicky blinked. She concentrated on keeping her breathing even.
"Bond? What nonsense are you talking about now?
Sister Georgia met Nicky's gaze squarely.
She insisted that if we swore allegiance to Richard, it would protect us. She claimed some magic of his would keep Jagang from our mind.
How? Sister Georgia shrugged.
She claimed this bond business protected people's minds from dreamwalkers, but we aren't that gullible.
To still her fingers, Nicky pressed her hands to her thighs.
I don't understand. How would such a thing work? She said something about it being inherited from his ancestor. She claimed that we had but to swear loyalty to him, loyalty in our hearts, or some such nonsense. To tell the truth, it was so preposterous I wasn't really paying that much attention. She claimed that was why Jagang couldn't enter her mind.
Nicky was staggered.
Of course!
She had always wondered why Jagang didn't capture the rest of the sisters. There were many more still free. They were protected by this bond to Richard. It had to be true. It made sense. Her own leader, Sister Eulysia, and Richard's other teachers had escaped too. But that didn't seem to make sense. They were sisters of the dark, like Nicky. They would have had to swear loyalty to Richard. Nicky couldn't imagine such a thing. But then, Jagang was often unable to enter Nicky's mind.
You said Sister Alessandra has vanished.
Sister Georgia fussed with the collar of her scruffy dress.
She and Anne both vanished.
Jagang doesn't bother to inform you of his actions. Perhaps he simply had them put to death. Georgia glanced at her companions.
Well, maybe. But Sister Alessandra was one of yours, a sister of the dark. She was caring for Anne.
Why weren't you caring for her? You are her sisters. Sister Georgia cleared her throat.
She threw such a fit about us that His Excellency assigned Sister Alessandra to look after her.
Nicky could only imagine that it must have been quite a fit. But after being betrayed by her own sisters, it was understandable. Jagang would have thought the woman valuable enough that he wanted to keep her alive.
As we marched into the city, the wagon with Anne's cage never showed up,
Sister Georgia went on.
One of the drivers finally came around with a bloody head and reported that the last thing he saw before the world went dark was Sister Alessandra. Now the two of them are gone.
Nicky felt her fingernails digging into her palms. She made herself relax her fists.
So, Anne offered you all freedom, and you chose instead to continue to be slaves.
The three women lifted their noses.
We did what is best for everyone,
Sister Georgia said.
We are sisters of the light. Our duty is not to ourselves, but to relieve the suffering of others, not cause it.
Besides, Sister Aubrey added,
we don't see you leaving. Seems you've been free of His Excellency from time to time, and you don't go.
Nicky frowned.
How do you know that? Well, I mean...
Sister Aubrey stammered. Nicky seized the woman by the throat.
I asked you a question. Answer it.
Sister Aubrey's face reddened as Nicky added the force of her gift to the grip. The tendons in her wrist stood out with the strain. The woman's eyes showed white all around as Nicky's power began squeezing the life from her. Unlike Nicky, Jagang possessed their minds, and they were prohibited from using their power except at his direction. Sister Georgia gently placed a hand on Nicky's forearm.
His Excellency questioned us about it. That's all, sister. Let her go, please.
Nicky released the woman but turned her glare on Sister Georgia.
Questioned you? What do you mean? What did he say? He simply wanted to know if we knew why he was from time to time blocked from your mind.
He hurt us, Sister Rochelle said.
He hurt us with his questions because we had no answer. We don't understand it.
For the first time, Nicky did. Sister Aubrey comforted her throat.
What is it with you, Sister Nicky? Why is it His Excellency is so curious about you? Why is it you can resist him?
Nicky turned and walked away.
Thank you for the help, sisters.
If you can be free of him, why do you not leave?
Sister Georgia called out. Nicky turned back from the doorway.
I enjoy seeing Jagang torment you, witches of the light. I stay around so that I might watch.
They were unmoved by her insolence. They were accustomed to it.
Sister Nicky, Rochelle said, smoothing back her frizz of hair, what did you do that made His Excellency so angry?
What?
Oh, that. Nothing of importance. I just had the men tie Commander Cardiff to a pole and roast him over a fire.
The three of them gasped as they straightened as one. They reminded Nicky of three owls on a branch. Sister Georgia fixed Nicky with a grim glare, a rare blaze of authority born of seniority.
You deserve everything Jagang does to you, sister, and what the Keeper will do to you, too.
Nicky smiled and said,
Yes, I do,
before ducking through the tent opening. Chapter 10 The city of Fairfield had returned to a semblance of order. It was the order of a military post. Little of what could be said to make a city was left. Many of the buildings remained, but there were few of the people who had once lived and worked in them. Some of the buildings had been reduced to charred beams and blackened rubble. Others were hulks with windows and doors broken out, yet most were much the same as they had been before, except, of course, that all had been emptied in the wanton looting. The buildings stood like husks, only a reminder of past life. Here and there, a few toothless old people sat, legs splayed, leaning against a wall, watching with empty eyes the masses of armed men moving up and down their streets. Orphan children wandered in a daze or peered out from dark passageways. Nicky found it remarkable how quickly civilization could be stripped from a place. As she walked through the streets, Nicky thought she understood how many of the buildings would feel, if they could feel, empty, devoid of life, lacking purpose while they waited for someone to serve, their only true value being in service to the living. The streets, populated as they were by grim-faced soldiers, gaunt beggars, the skeletal old and sick, wailing children, all amongst the rubble and filth, looked much like some of the streets Nicky remembered from when she was little. Her mother often sent her out to streets like this to minister to the destitute.
"It's the fault of men like your father," her mother had said. "He's just like my father was. He has no feelings, no concern for anyone but himself. He's heartless."
Nicky had stood, wearing a freshly washed frilly blue dress, her hair brushed and pinned back, her hands hanging at her sides, listening as her mother lectured on good and evil, on the ways of sin and redemption. Nicky hadn't understood a lot of it, but in later years it would be repeated until she would come to know every word, every concept, every desolate truth by heart. Nicky's father was wealthy. Worse, to Mother's way of thinking, he wasn't remorseful about it. Mother explained that self-interest and greed were like the two eyes of a monstrous evil, always looking for yet more power and gold to feed its insatiable hunger.
"You must learn, Nicky, that a person's moral course in this life is to help others, not yourself," Mother said. "Money can't buy the Creator's blessing."
"But how can we show the Creator we're good?" Nicky asked.
"Mankind is a wretched lot, unworthy, morbid, and foul. We must fight our depraved nature. Helping others is the only way to prove your soul's value. It's the only true good a person can do."
Nicky's father had been born a noble, but all his adult life he had worked as an armorer. Mother believed that he had been born with comfortable wealth, and instead of being satisfied with that, he sought to build his legacy into a shameless fortune. She said wealth could only be had by fleecing it from the poor in one fashion or another. Others of the nobility, like Mother and many of her friends, were content not to squeeze an undeserved share from the sweat of the poor. Nicky felt great guilt for Father's wicked ways, for his ill-gotten wealth. Mother said she was doing her best to try to save his straying soul. Nikki never worried for her mother's soul, because people were always saying how caring, how kind-hearted, how charitable Mother was. But Nikki would sometimes lie awake at night, unable to sleep with worry for Father, worry that the Creator might exact punishment before Father could be redeemed. While Mother went to meetings with her important friends, the nanny, on the way to market, often took Nikki to Father's business to ask his wishes for dinner. Nikki relished watching and learning things at Father's work. It was a fascinating place. When she was very young, she thought she might grow up to be an armorer, too. At home, she would sit on the floor and play at hammering on an item of clothing meant to be armor laid on an upturned shoe used as an anvil. That innocent time was her fondest memory of her childhood. Nikki's father had a great many people working for him. Wagons brought four square bars and other supplies from distant places. Heavy cast metal sows came in on barges. Other wagons with guards took goods to far-off customers. There were men who forged metal, men who hammered it into shape, and yet other men who shaped glowing metal into weapons. Some of the blades were made from costly poison steel, said to inflict mortal wounds even in a small cut. There were other men who sharpened blades, men who polished armor, and men who did beautiful engraving and artwork on shields, armor, and blades. There were even women who worked for Nikki's father, helping to make chainmail. Nikki watched them sitting on benches at long wooden tables, gossiping a bit among themselves, tittering at stories, as they worked with their pincers burring over tiny rivets in the flattened ends of all those thousands of little steel rings that together went into the making of a suit of chainmail armor. Nikki thought it remarkable that man's inventiveness could turn something as hard as metal into a suit of clothes. Men from all around, and from distant places too, came to buy her father's armor. Father said it was the finest armor made. His eyes, the color of the blue sky on a perfect summer day, sparkled wonderfully when he spoke of his armor. Some were so beautiful that kings traveled from great distances to have armor ordered and fitted. Some were so elaborate that it took skilled men hunched at benches many months to make. Blacksmiths, bellowsmen, hammermen, millmen, platers, armorers, polishers, leatherworkers, riveters, pattern makers, silversmiths, gilders, engraving artists, even seamstresses for the making of the quilted and padded linen, and, of course, apprentices, came from great distances hoping to work for her father. Many of those with skills lugged along samples of their best work to show him. Father turned away far more than he hired. Nikki's father was an impressive figure, upright, angular, and intense. At his work, his blue eyes always seemed to Nikki to see more than any other person saw, as if the metal spoke to him when his fingers glided over it. He seemed to move his limbs precisely as much as was needed, and no more. To Nikki, he was a vision of power, strength, and purpose. Officers, officials, and nobility came round to talk to him, as did suppliers and his workers. When Nikki went to her father's work, she was always astonished to see him engaged in so much conversation. Mother said it was because he was arrogant, and made his poor workers pay court to him. Nikki liked to watch the intricate dance of people working. The workers would pause to smile at her, answer her questions, and sometimes let her hit the metal with a hammer. From the looks of it, Father enjoyed talking to all those people, too. At home, Mother talked, and Father said little, as his face took on the look of hammered steel. When he did talk at home, he spoke almost exclusively about his work. Nikki listened to every word, wanting to learn all about him and his business. Mother confided that at his core, his vile nature ate away at his invisible soul. Nikki always hoped someday to redeem his soul and make it as healthy as he outwardly appeared. He adored Nikki, but seemed to think raising her was a task too sacred for his coarse hands, so he left it to Mother. Even when he disagreed with something, he would bow to Mother's wishes, saying she would know best about such a domestic duty. His work kept him busy most of the time. Mother said it was a sign of his barren soul that he spent so much of his time at building his riches, taking from people, she often called it, rather than giving of himself to people, as the Creator meant all men to do. Many times when Father came home for dinner, While servants scurried in and out with all the dishes they'd prepared, Mother would go on in tortured tones about how bad things were in the world. Nicky often heard people say that Mother was a noble woman because of how deeply she cared. After dinner, Father would go back to work, often without a word. That would anger Mother because she had more to tell him about his soul, but he was too busy to listen. Nicky remembered occasions when Mother would stand at the window, looking out over the dark city, worrying, no doubt, about all the things that plagued her peace. On those quiet nights, Father sometimes glided up behind Mother, putting a hand tenderly to her back as if she were something of great value. He seemed to be mellow and contented at those moments. He squeezed her bottom just a little as he whispered something in her ear. She would look up hopefully and ask him to contribute to the efforts of her fellowship. He would ask how much. Peering up into his eyes as if searching for some shred of human decency, she would name a figure. He would sigh and agree. His hands would settle around her waist, and he would say that it was late, and that they should retire to bed. Once when he asked her how much she wished him to contribute, she shrugged and said, "I don't know. What does your conscience tell you, Howard? But a man of true compassion would do better than you usually do, considering that you have more than your fair share of wealth, and the need is so great." He sighed. "How much do you and your friends need?"
"It's not me and my friends who need it, Howard, but the masses of humanity crying out for help. Our fellowship simply struggles to meet the need."
"How much?" he repeated. She said,
500 gold crowns.
As if the number were a club she had been hiding behind her back, and seeing the opening she had been waiting for, she suddenly brandished it to bully him. With a gasp, Father staggered back a step.
"Do you have any idea of the work required to make a sum of that size?"
"You do no work, Howard. Your slaves do it for you."
"Slaves? They are the finest craftsmen."
"They should be. You steal the best workers from all over the land.
I pay the best wages in the land. They are eager to work for me."
"They are the poor victims of your tricks. You exploit them. You charge more than anyone else. You have connections and make deals to cut out other armorers. You steal the food from the mouths of working people just to line your own pockets."
"I offer the finest work. People buy from me because they want the best. I charge a fair price for it."
"No one charges as much as you, and that's the simple fact. You always want more. Gold is your only goal."
"People come to me willingly because I have the highest standards. That is my goal. The other shops produce haphazard work that doesn't proof out. My tempering is superior. My work is all proof to a double-stamp standard. I won't sell inferior work. People trust me. They know I create the best pieces."
"Your workers do. You simply rake in the money."
"The profits go to wages and to the business. I just sank a fortune into the new battering mill."
"Business, business, business. When I ask you to give a little something back to the community, to those in need, you act as if I wanted you to gouge out your eyes. Would you really rather see people die than to give a pittance to save them? Does money really mean more to you, Howard, than people's lives? Are you that cruel and unfeeling a man?"
Father hung his head for a time, and at last quietly agreed to send his man around with the gold. His voice came gentle again. He said he didn't want people to die, and he hoped the money would help. He told her it was time for bed.
"You've put me off, Howard, with your arguing. You couldn't just give charitably of yourself. It always has to be dragged out of you when it's the right thing to do in the first place. You only agree now because of your lecherous needs. Honestly, do you think I have no principles?"
Father simply turned and headed for the door. He paused as he suddenly saw Nicky sitting on the floor, watching. The look on his face frightened her, not because it was angry or fierce, but because there seemed to be so much in his eyes, and the weight of never being able to express it was crushing him. Raising Nicky was Mother's work, and he had promised her he would not meddle. He swept his blonde hair back from his forehead, then turned and picked up his coat. In a level voice, he said to Mother that he was going to go see to some things at work. After he was gone, Mother too saw Nicky, forgotten on the floor, playing with beads on a board, pretending to make chainmail. Her arms folded, she stood over Nicky for a long moment.
This is the end of Side 1. This program is continued on Side 2 of this cassette.